Every day by Cross Insurance, where security meets strength. We have a jam-packed show today, so we'll get right to it here. Coming up on the program, we talk Celtics with John Corrales at the bottom of the hour. Eric Meehan from Bangor Wine and Cheese Company with this week's Message in the Bottle. Writer Colin Fleming in the 5 o'clock hour. Dennis Price with an entertainment report. But we get things underway this afternoon by welcoming to the program a singer-songwriter who has been producing terrific music for more than 30 years now, originally part of the very successful country music duet Foster and Lloyd, and then making his own wonderful music for many, many years. He's also the author of a new book of short stories based on some of his songs called For You to See the Stars. And we're very happy to have Radney Foster with us this afternoon. Radney, this is Rich. Thanks so much for being with us today.
It's an honor. It's a pleasure. It's not every day you get asked to be on Stephen King's radio station. especially the fact that, you know, you guys want to talk both about songwriting, literary writing, and everything else in the world.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a fan of your work forever, and let's go back to the beginning. You began writing songs as a teenager. Was it Randy Goodrum who suggested you do that as a full-time thing?
Actually, that is wrong on Wikipedia, which is really funny because Randy is a really good friend and was a very influential in helping me stay in Nashville. But my mother disabused me. I always thought I started writing songs as a teenager, but my mother told me that was a lie and that she has copies of songs I wrote in Sunday school when I was 7, 8 years old.
Wow.
And So I was playing I went to the University of the South at Sewanee. It's a small liberal arts college on a mountain in Tennessee. I was playing in a band up there that was sort of kind of nitty-gritty dirt bandish. And a guy came up to us after the show, and he said, you know, what band does those 3 songs? Because I know everything else y'all did, you know. And he said, my guitar player or somebody said, hey, you can't get them. Our singer wrote them. And he said, well, I don't know, you know, jack squat about the music business, but I got a buddy who's a producer in Nashville. And I'm like, yeah, right. And I wrote my number down on a matchbook. You know, this is back in ancient history days, and which was the payphone at the end of the hall in the dorm. And sure enough, 2 weeks later, I had a note tacked on my door that said, call Brown Bannister, and it had a Nashville area code on. And I had just read in, like, Rolling Stone that about this young producer who had won a Grammy for this brand-new ingenue Amy Grant and for a B.J. Thomas comeback record and all this kind of stuff. I was like, wait a minute, that's a real guy. And so I played 4 or 5 songs for him, and he said, hit for Brown, and he said, man, you got to have a serious talk with your mom and dad about, you know, doing this for a living. And so, you know, in typical fashion, I took a year off from college, and I waited tables, and I worked as a camp counselor and did every odd job I could think of. But during that time, I met Randy Goodrum, and he was very kind to me and really dug my songs and helped me do. I would trade babysitting his kids for doing an acoustic demo in his basement studio. And he really helped me, you know, I found one publisher because of him who wouldn't throw me out of his office, you know, and I was off to the races, you know. So I went back and finished college because, you know, a deal was a deal with my folks. But I moved right back to Nashville after that.
How'd you get together with Bill Lloyd?
We both signed to Mary Tyler Moore's publishing company within a month of each other in 1985. And Mary Tyler Moore had, you know, and Grant Tinker had made, you know, with the MTM production house, had made so many gazillions in television that they were looking for a way to, you know, own publishing and do a whole another side of it in the entertainment industry. I mean, in the music industry, and they were pretty successful for a little while. And there's a woman there who's named Meredith Stewart, and she just was one of those, you know, A&R folks who really knew how to pick and find young talent. And she signed, you know, 8 young writers, and within 2 or 3 years, each of us had written, you know, a number one record. And Dell and I were sort of the young Turks. I played acoustic guitar and sang, and he played electric guitar and sang, and we would try to figure out how to, you know, do the demos to our songs, by just hiring a bass player and a drummer, and it would be less expensive. And you know, we'd sing all the parts and put all the guitar and vocal stuff together, and that ended up becoming the band Foster and Lloyd, and how we got, you know, we ended up getting a song cut from that work by a group called Sweethearts of the Rodeo, mm-hmm. and then RCA got interested, and you know, they said, "Do you want to play a showcase?" And we did, and we borrowed Steve Earle's guitar player and the bass player from Ricky Skaggs and the steel player from Ricky Skaggs, and we all rehearsed, and you know, it was all lawyers, guns, and money from there to, you know.
Well, you guys,
Horn Savant.
You guys had great success. Foster and Lloyd, 3 albums at 9 chart hits, and that certainly could have continued that level of success, but both of you wanted to go off and do your own thing.
Yeah, I mean, it was an odd time in Nashville. We were under this situation where our A&R guys at RCA were great. I'm really convinced that we could do really well. But there was a change in the regime as far as the radio programmer, you know, the radio side of things. And they were convinced that we were just too out there to get played, just too hard to work, you know. And so there was talk of, like, do we want to move over? Because we'd had some pop success, too, and college rock success. So they were like, well, do you want to move to the New York office? And I just felt like, you know, I couldn't go pop with a mouth full of firecrackers to quote, you know, Buck Cohen. I have a West Texas speech impediment. And so we kind of amicably split. Bill went to work as an A&R guy for a little while, and then on to start a band that was signed to Warner Brothers and produced Carl Perkins during that time period. He did a lot of cool things. I ended up spending a year on the road opening for Mary Chapin and Carpenter and for Vince Gill, which is me and my guitar. And that really honed my craft sort of away from just a sound and towards, you know, more storytelling aspect of songwriting. It was a good trial by fire. And so that ended up with me getting signed to Arista Records.
We're talking with Rodney Foster here on Downtown. Well, that turned into your first solo album in 1992. From my money, one of the absolute best albums of the last 30 years, regardless of genre. Del Rio, Texas, 1959. Every song on there is great. 5 hits from the album, and every one of them is a keeper. It's never left my heavy rotation. I think one of the best songs on the album is A Fine Line. I love the storytelling in that.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, that's a guy you don't want to be. he's between a rock and a hard place.
Oh, yeah.
you know, for the audience that hadn't heard it, you know, you can find it on Apple Music or wherever it is that you listen these days. But it's about a guy who's got a wife and 2 kids, and he's got a mistress that's pregnant. And, you know, he never really intended for this to work out the way it is. But he's got soul searching to do, and basically he's at that inflection point where you realize, like, somebody's getting hurt in this deal. You know, nobody gets out without a broken heart.
Hey, you also got Mary Chapin Carpenter to lend a little vocal work on Nobody Wins.
Oh yeah, that was really born out of opening for her, becoming friends with her on the tour bus. I mean, I had known her a lot before then. I'd known her since we had, you know, since probably 86 or 87, when we were in Foster and Lloyd. But that was kind of when I really became friends with her, and she taught me. It also changed a big part of my guitar playing, because she's just a master at alternate tunings. And, you know, I learned a couple from her, and then went down the rabbit hole and started really studying all the things that David Crosby had done, and you know, that really set me free. I you know, there's not a record I've made in the last 20 years that doesn't have some alternate tuning on at least one song.
I did a couple more albums for Arista, Labor of Love, a great album, See What You Want to See, that had terrific collaborations with Emmy Lou and Darius Rucker. Did you get jerked around by the record company a little bit there?
In a way, the bizarre thing is that See What You Want to See, you know, I'd had this opportunity to go pop with Bill and turned it down, and so the Labor of Love record was less, Delia Texas Nights Get Down was very well received at country radio, and the Labor of Love record, not so much. And so I, during that time, I went through a divorce, and I had a son, I went through a divorce, I actually got remarried, all kinds of things, happened. And so a lot of big changes, and there was a hiatus between albums, and I, started turning in these new songs, and my label head, Tim Dubois, said, "These songs are amazing, but they're not going to get played on country radio." And I said, "Well, this is what I'm going to do." And he said, "Well, I'll help you go anywhere in the world you want to go. I'll call Clive Davis to see if you want to go to Arista, New York, or I'll find out where help you get this place." He said, "But before you go anywhere else, we're starting this new division called Arista Texas." And I was like, "Great." Mm. So I meet with the guys down there, and they were ecstatic and fell in love with it. And the first single off of See What You Want to See was I'm In with Aubra Moore as a duet. And it was the most added record at what they used to call AAA, which was kind of, folky, alt-rock, country, Americana, right, all thrown in together.
Right.
And they closed the label that week. So what happened was that, Clive Davis got in that argument. I don't know if you guys remember this, but he got in an argument with the parent company, BMG, and had to retire because they had this mandatory retirement age.
Right, right.
And then so he left Arista, and then of course they turned around and gave him $1 gazillion to start his own label, on top of that. When the new guy came in, they were like, "Man, I don't know anything about this Americana and Red Dirt and what you're doing with this Arista Texas thing, close it down." And so that was how I ended up, sort of a free agent, was just, they closed the label when I had the most added single in America.
Man, speaking of collaborations, your name came up a few weeks ago when we had one of my other favorite songwriters in the world on the show, Marshall Crenshaw.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I've written a couple songs with Marshall, and especially back in the Foster and Lloyd days. And he actually played on our second album, Faster and Louder.
As a songwriter, and you've had so many of your songs that be hits for others, folks like Keith Urban, Sarah Evans, Kinley's, you mentioned Sweethearts of the Rodeo. Is that like sending your child out into the world wondering what it will be like when you see it again?
It is in a way, but it's also, it can be a very, very successful child. They went to law school and can help you with your retirement. So it is a double-edged sword. But I tell people all the time, people are like, "Okay, how in the world do you write songs for other people?" And, I started out as a staff songwriter, and there's a discipline to that of like, you kind of were pretty much expected to come up with at least a song a week. And there were guys who were really great at knowing, it's like, Dolly Parton's going into the studio at the end of the month. We got to write a Dolly Parton song. And I was like, and I was baffled by that. I couldn't do it. I'm going to go back to Meredith Stewart, who was a great publisher, and our person. And she finally told me, "I think that all of that stuff is confusing you. I don't want you to ever think about it again. Just go write what you write, and I'll help find a home for it." And So that became my philosophy. Just write a song I love and really care about. And it will find a home, either with me as an indie artist, or through my publisher, they'd pitch it to somebody else. And oftentimes, a lot of people would hear my record who are on a major label, and I'd sold, 30,000 copies of it, and they were like, my 3.5 million fans, they really don't really know this guy's music, so it's perfectly acceptable to me for me to just lift right off of that record, which I was fine with, yes, sir, you go do your version however you would like to.
Well, I really want to talk a lot about the most recent project for you, To See the Stars. It is so remarkable, but the story behind it is worth telling as well. And it began with the scariest thing that can happen to a performer, and that's losing your voice.
Yeah, and for a long time. I got pneumonia and laryngitis in the winter of 2015, 2016, through that, sort of December and January. And I had to cancel a 6-month tour. I was unable to speak for 3 months. And it wasn't like they just said, okay, if you'll just completely shut up for 3 months, then we'll, and actually it was about 2 solid months of zero speaking. And then it was like, you can speak for 10 minutes and then you can have to shut up for 2 hours. And you still can't sing yet, it was like, and I would go back week after week. I would go each week. You would go in and they say, no, you still can't speak. So you get a month in, and you've sung all your life. And at the end of a month, you've gone 4 times to the doctor. They've scoped your voice and they say, you still can't talk and you still can't sing. And that becomes a real mind crisis. And so I was going crazy, and I wrote a note to my wife and said, babe, I'm going to try to write a short story just to keep from going crazy, to give myself something creative to do. And she didn't answer me. She picked up the pen out of my hand and wrote down on the same piece of paper, you should, because you're driving me crazy. And that was the beginning of my literary career, that right there. I wrote a short story, which is the last one in the book, which is really novella length. It's about 13,000 words, I think. And it was based on a song by the same name called Sycamore Creek. I handed it to my wife, and who was a journalist for many, many years and a magazine editor for many, many years. And she read it and said, congratulations, this is really good. And you need to keep writing this way. Once you, once you get healed up, continue to write songs, but you need to continue to write short stories. And so I did. And, a couple of them were inspired by songs. And then a couple of them I had written that were out of thin air. And I went, I could just write a song to go with those other two. Hey, wait a second. I put out an album of songs and a short story to go with each song. And so that's what I did. And yes, it's both a book and a CD or an album collection, download, whatever, however it is that you listen to music, of 10 songs and 10 short stories.
Well, I'd listen to the album first and love the music, as I always do with your stuff, but then went back and read the book, and it's phenomenal, and the writing is so good. You wrote me in right away with the first story in the book about James Garrison Smallwood and his grandfather, and did such a beautiful job of making me visualize lands that I've never seen before.
Oh, thank you so much. That is kind. I was born and raised in West Texas, Del Rio, Texas, 1959 is, the title of that record, but that is when and where I was born. And, Del Rio is in one of those odd places in that it was right on the Mexican border. I was literally, my house was a mile or so from Mexico. I could ride my bike to the bridge, And yet you're, you know, the nearest big city was San Antonio, but equidistant from there was the Big Bend country, you know, Alpine and Marfa and that entire area. And of course, it's much cooler up there. And, you know, you'd go camping there, or you'd go up to the national park, and often that was a you know, first stop if we were on family vacations going up to New Mexico and Colorado. You know, our first stop would be sort of in the Big Bend area up in that park, and in particularly in Alpine and Marfa, where it's cool. And so I fell in love with that country, and I knew I wanted to write something about that. And I knew that I wanted a subject matter that dealt with death and reconciliation. And so I came up with the granddad and the dad, and sort of the, I won't do the spoiler alert, but it's a grandson, a father, and a father-in-law, and the dad and the granddad have had a little conspiracy going on for a while.
It's beautiful, and I love, I want to read a line, because it just, I dog-eared the page immediately. I was just so moved by this line from It Ain't Done With Me. Real regrets haunt you at sunset when the light reminds you of a tenderness you can never get back. Man, that is just some beautiful writing.
Oh, thank you very, very much, man. That was a really fun story to write, because I knew I wanted to set my sights on something that I said, well, who has, I you know, regrets that you can't talk about? And I know a couple of guys who are, you know, former military, but they were all special forces, the two of them that I know. And, you know, that when they say, you know, I can't tell you, but I'd have to kill you, they mean it. Everything they've done is classified, you know. And I'd had the song already written, I'm Done With The Past, But It Ain't Done With Me. And it's sort of a Waylon Jennings rocker about regret. And I just knew I wanted to put that song on the album. So I thought, well, who has, you know, what? Let's deal with the complications of things that, you know, got left untied and undone, and or went badly, and you can't talk about it. And so I came up with the character, and it, for the audience out there, it's a reunion between a retired spy and his daughter, and it all takes place in one night in New Orleans.
We're talking with Radney Foster. His book is called For You to See the Stars. And so many great characters that you develop in these stories. I hope somewhere in the world there is a real Isabel Villarreal who can ask those important questions of us.
She is purely out of my imagination, but she is probably an amalgamation of several women that I grew up with. So there you go.
A great piece of writing, too, about a very scary dystopian future and another dragon to slay. And man, that song, when I connected the two, I like the song already, but when I put those together, and you wrote this, what, 4 years ago?
I wrote it right before the election. I wrote the song and I want to say August of 2016, and I put it out just acoustically, and my wife found a ton of footage from the 1930s and 40s concerning fascism and authoritarianism as well. I mean, there's some both left and right authoritarian and Civil War issues, Spanish Civil War, and we put it out there because I really feared at the time that, you know, we were, you know, flirting with, you know, very, very authoritarian thought processes. And, unfortunate. And I was like, you know, democracy is a fragile thing. And, you know, what happens if the United States breaks up? You know, what does that entail? What the hell does that look like? you know, and it's that story is about a guy who they call the old man, and he's Sergeant Mota, and he basically is stuck between a rock and a hard place. And the interesting thing about him as a character is that he is having to fight in the Army to try to figure out how to not only maintain his citizenship, but to get full citizenship instead, you know, for his kids someday. And the citizenship in that country, which is one of the countries that's born out of the United States, is a two-tiered system. There's first-class citizens, and then there's everybody else. And so I actually just took laws that are on the books in countries across the world concerning immigration and citizenship, and but how can you align these in the most horrific way possible? And so I did. So he is stuck, and he is stuck at the siege of Denver. And I'll leave it at that, so that people can figure out when they read it what they want to take from it.
Well, it takes place several years in the future, but boy, it seems eerily prescient. And on the one hand, great job, you nailed it. On the other hand, now I'm even more scared.
Yeah, I just thank you. I've had several fans go, did you know you're being prophetic when you wrote All That I Require? And I said, no, frankly, I just thought it was a warning tale, and that way we would, you know, get past it, you know. And but apparently we are still in the thick and throes of questioning both the writ of our Constitution and the traditions of this thing we call the Democratic Republic.
Now, lest anybody think the album and the stories are all heavy, no, there are some wonderful moments. And I, frankly, having done all three, I think the best way to approach this collection is to listen to the audiobook and hear you read it, because it's great. And I was listening in my car and laughing out loud as a radio guy and a rock and roll guy, too, listening to The Night Demon took me back to that little Panasonic transistor I had as a kid.
Yeah, that I love that kid. He's a stinker, I mean, but I love him to death. And he is a little like me, you know. Obviously, I grew up, you know, Del Rio had one of the border blasters, one of the really big ones. And I am too young to remember Wolfman Jack, who was on the air from 1960 to 62 for 3 years. And there in Del Rio, and you could hear him. And I mean, you know, in Greenland or in the fillings in your teeth, I mean, you know, they had five RCA 50,000 watt transmitters and 110-foot stick, and they'd crank them as hard as they would go at night, and you know, so that they could be heard. And it became, you know, one of the first places you know, they'd have preachers, they'd have rock and roll. The Carter family lived during World War II in Del Rio,
right?
You know, and broadcast twice a day on the radio. And so, you know, that was still going on to a certain extent, and the whole sort of progressive country, outlaw country thing was happening in the early 70s. And there was a guy named Paul Callinger, who's now in the DJ Hall of Fame. And he was on there, and he would, he'd spin those, you know, records. And he didn't care whether Nashville thought it was country or not. If it would keep a trucker awake, he was fine with it. You know, I mean, you'd hear Creedence Clearwater Revival 1 minute, and then you'd hear, you know, Dave Dudley, and then you'd hear Willie Nelson, and then you'd hear Patsy Cline, and then you'd hear Ray Price, and then you'd hear the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. I mean, it was all over the map, and it had a massive influence on my music, and I thought, I got to write something about that.
Well, that's a wonderful story, and again, it gives me an even greater appreciation for The Wanderer.
Oh, yeah, right?
Well, it is it's such a wonderful package. The way to do it is to experience, like I said, all three, get the collection of the book, the audiobook, which is fabulous, and the CD of For You to See the Stars, and you're going to love it. It is beautiful writing. It is, as always, tremendous music. Randy, I've loved your work for so long, and it's great to have a chance finally to talk with you after all these years.
Thanks so much. Hey, by the way, let me tell everybody, I mean, I know you can get it off of Amazon or some other place like that, but if you go to RadneyFoster.com, it comes autographed. So, you know, you can get the book, the CD, or the audio book, and I sign every one that goes out, you know, along with a lot of other stuff that we have in there. And this time when, you know, I can't tour and make any of my living that way, it sure does help if somebody wants to, you know, it's never too early to think about Christmas. It's right around the corner.
Darn right. Get it from the source. Always the best way to do it. Randy, thanks so much. It's been a blast.
Oh, the pleasure is all mine, man. Thanks so much. And I have to say also, I would be remiss if I didn't say that, you know, I found it a tremendous thrill when Stephen name-checked me and Mr. Mercedes. And I got a real thrill out of that. And that's a great book. But if you get a chance to pass along to him, I cannot express how much this book was affected by reading on writing. I mean, that's a tour de force as far as, you know, how to and storytelling and paying attention to style and voice and letting it be yourself. You know, it was a tremendous, tremendous help when I first started writing.
That's great. It ought to be a textbook in schools. It's so good.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Randy, appreciate you making time for us today, and hope we can get you back out on the road so people can see you in person, and hopefully we can do this again sometime down the road.
Oh, yeah, and thanks so much, guys. I really appreciate it.